This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with literary agent and longtime activist Frances Golden.
Frances is the literary agent for Mamiya Abu-Jamal. She's helped him publish 6 books, and she visits prisoners on death row all the time.
We'll hear from Laura Whitehorn and Susie Day, both contributors to Let Freedom Ring.
Laura's a living example of the fact that these struggles can be won. Political prisoners can be freed.
We'll talk with Matt Meyer, editor of the recently published book, Let Freedom Ring.
This book documents scores, maybe hundreds, of political prisoners in the United States. If you didn't think the U.S. held political prisoners, you're wrong.
Stay with us. Among the many contributors to the book Let Freedom Ring is ex-political prisoner and native New Yorker Laura Whitehorn. Since the 1960s, Laura was active in supporting groups such as the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Movement, and was active with Students for a Democratic Society and the Weather Underground. She also worked to expose the FBI's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. Laura was arrested in 1985, convicted of the 1983 U.S. Capitol bombing, and charged with conspiracy to oppose, protest, and change the policies and practices of the U.S. government in domestic and international matters by violence and illegal means. She was sentenced to 20 years in prison, was released in August 1999 after 14 years. Laura lives in New York City and is active in a wide range of progressive issues. She joins us today with her partner, political activist and author Susie Day, who also contributed to Let Freedom Ring. Welcome, Laura and Susie, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It is great to have you, both of you, authors of and compilers of essays in Let Freedom Ring, which is this incredible book on political prisoners in the United States, but that is really needed and filled a huge gap, as we've said. It's so wide, people don't know there's political prisoners.
Well, thank you. We're only two of the many authors in that.
Many of whom, unfortunately, are still in prison and others who have died there. But I think listeners to this show in particular who've been hearing about torture and about the trashing of any constitutional rights for the last 8 years and now are thinking this is time for, you know, this is our time in the sun.
Laura, you yourself have been active and, in fact, have been a political prisoner. Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Well, I'm very much like probably a lot of people that you know and who've been on this show. I'm in my 60s now, so that it goes without saying if I'm a political activist, I probably was in the 60s, which is where I started out, moved by the Black liberation struggle in particular and the struggle of the Vietnamese people against the United States war. Anyway, all those years, which probably a lot of your listeners can talk about too, I ended up spending years in prison later for a case called the Resistance Conspiracy case. And our indictment was a thing of beauty. I can't quote it exactly, but it was something like conspiracy to protest change and oppose policies and practices of the U.S. government in domestic and international matters by violent and illegal means. And so we said, aha, whose means are violent and illegal? That gave us a political aspect of our case. It was a series of bombings of buildings. No one was ever hurt. Great care was taken. And one of them was the U.S. Capitol. Here in New York, there was the Police Benevolent Association. I love that name. Right after the murder of Eleanor Bumpers. And I met Susie while I was in prison. She was interested in the issue of political prisoners.
Well, yeah, I came very new to it. And in fact, I sort of represent much more of a mainstream than Laura does, and still do. I mean, that's sort of the basis of a relationship is a lot of arguing.
You have a noisy relationship?
Yeah. Ask the neighbors. No. No, I sort of was intrigued at all the compromises that most of us every day and make, you know, for decades. You know, we cut corners in order to go to our jobs, to raise kids, to pay the rent. And we support involuntarily things that we abhor. Like, I work at a corporate law firm part-time for money, even though I detest its politics. So I was interested in people who did not compromise, who lived underground, who, not literally, but who would go to the extreme of giving up their lives, of basically middle-class educated comfort, where they would and give up their identities and to fight an establishment that made it so easy for everybody else to just get along, or not everybody else, but, you know, white people mostly. And so I went down to the D.C. jail, and I met Laura and four of her co-defendants, Susan Rosenberg, Marilyn Buck, Linda Evans. And I was blown away, actually.
Yeah, your essay in the book, Let Freedom Ring, is 1989, Susie, and it's about Laura's case.
Yeah.
And then you have an essay, of course, about Mamiya a few years later.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, when you mentioned, of the people you saw, of course, Laura's out of prison now. How many years did you serve, Laura?
14 and change.
Oh, my God. Because I'm so used to seeing you out.
In fact, all of us except for Marilyn Buck, and she actually will be out in the next few years.
I was going to say, you're out, Alan Berkman is out, Timothy Blunk, Marilyn Buck will be out soon, as you're saying, Linda Evans, Susan Rosenberg, and Elizabeth Duke.
No, Laura, I read that interview with you and Linda Evans and Susan Rosenberg. It's worth the price of the book, just that interview.
And
it was an interview about what it's like to be a lesbian prisoner in an American prison. Talk to us about what you did, like your day-to-day activities and how you held up in there.
Day-to-day activities. I think Mumia gives the best description of that in one of his first books, where he talks about the banality, the sameness, the no change, the no input of prison, and how long the days can be and how you can't even tell time. But in the D.C. jail during this period in 1988, when we were in the D.C. jail, we were there for 3 years, was the beginning of what we see now as a huge AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. And it was at a time when there was absolute fear and stigma, no drugs to treat HIV. And so we started to learn about HIV and to do counseling. And we all did that. And almost all the political prisoners, I mean, I know David Gilbert has done that. Kathy Boudin and Judy Clark did it in Bedford Hills. Herman has done some, Herman Bell, because the AIDS epidemic is huge in prisons. You know, a quarter of the people with HIV in this country go through prisons at some point, and the rate of HIV in the prisons is twice what it is on the streets. And so that was part of our work. But, you know, how I stayed, I don't know, how I kept my spirits. There's a funny thing with political prisoners. The main purpose in some ways of locking people away is to destroy us politically. And by that, I don't mean torture on our heads and playing yellow polka dot bikini very loud or something like that. It's more denying your political status. So the fact that the government denies that there are political prisoners is right away, it's a denigration of everything that you stand for and everything that you fought for that got you there. Second of all, keeping you from other prisoners. Very often political prisoners are held in isolation, as we were in D.C. jail until we made a big stink and fought, and Bill Kunstler had to come down and yell at the judge about his techniques. And then keeping us from what was going on the outside. And I think that one of the reasons this book is so important, and that it's so important for people to learn about political prisoners, is that every single one of the political prisoners now inside and ever inside is there for something they did in the course of being part of a movement. So if you remove people from the movement, you take away their identity, then you're killing them in a way. For us, it was very important that we did have a lot of support. At that moment, there were so many political prisoners and so many women political prisoners, and it's in this country much easier for people to sympathize with women in prison than men. So that was, you know, something to our advantage, although the sympathy stops very quickly, but at least people are interested. Why are those girls in there?
Well, Susie, you mentioned in your essay on Laura about an extra level of oppression, not just being a woman, but being a lesbian.
Yes. Well, I was basically, talking to Laura about that, so I personally don't know what it's like to be a lesbian in prison.
But you know what it's like to be the lesbian lover visiting a lesbian in prison, because we became involved, and then later on you visited me in California, and you remember that, where they wouldn't let us hold hands.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, they would let the heterosexual couples, hold hands, and sort of a little PDA, as the high schoolers say. You know, they really watched us much more closely.
All their homophobia came out.
Yeah. But I wanted to say, Michael Ratner, you mentioned all the people who in Laura's case are now out or will be soon.
Right.
I wanted to say that one of the purposes of this book is not just historical. It is, I hope, to give people a basis to start working to get the rest of the political prisoners out, many of whom, I think, probably most at this point, are not white people. And, you know, white people tend to have much better luck, not always, but
we've noticed that.
Getting out.
I think that's an important point. Yeah. I mean, that this is really a book of struggle and of the fact that victories can be won, and that with the right kind of political work and agitation, people actually can get out.
Yeah, but it's really fascinating to me how there's so much interest in the 60s. The Weather Underground movie and all the books and this and that, and everybody wants to read about it and talk about it and hear about it. But what about the people who are still in prison? Most of them are black and Puerto Rican and Native American. I mean, look at Leonard Peltier, recognized internationally as a political prisoner from the siege at Wounded Knee, one of the high points of resistance in this country, which if you know, there are films about it. They made a Hollywood picture about it. But somehow that doesn't translate into a willingness by the general population to say enough is enough. That people have been in since the late 60s and the early 70s. They've been in almost 40 years. So whatever people were convicted of, and you know because you were a lawyer on some of the early cases, how many irregularities there were, but let's leave that aside for now. Say everyone's guilty. Just say it for argument. How much time do you have to serve in this country? What kind of country do we have that relies on punishment rather than rehabilitation, reconciliation? In Europe.
Yeah, but maximum is really 20 years. I mean, sometimes they go farther, but basically 20
that's
years.
That's life.
That's what's considered a life sentence in Europe.
You can be St. Teresa in prison.
Right.
And you can have 50 million job offers and everything else. You can have saved the warden's life. And if you were a Black Panther and you go to the board, they say, you can't get out. Why not? Well, we recognize that you've done a lot in prison and blah, blah, blah. But the nature of your offense.
Right.
I mean, okay, so now we have Obama, and I was crying on Inauguration Day and all that too. But, you know, we still have the same system. We still have the same criminal justice system. We still have the same repression. It looks prettier now. And we still have the same racism. So if you are a radical and you think, wow, how are we going to struggle in this period? And, you know, well, let's fight for justice. Let's recreate justice in this country. Let's have a new image of what it would mean, not just for political prisoners, but that would be key, because whatever happens to political prisoners is going to happen to everyone else. We were held in preventive detention before it was a common thing. Now everyone knows what it is. Back when I was held in preventive detention in 1985, people would say, what's that?
Right.
Yeah, she broke a record with Philip Ojeda Rios, I believe, for the longest held.
Really? I didn't know that. I realized you were in a preventive detention, but for how long?
It's a little hard for me to remember now, but it was over 3 years.
We're speaking with Laura Whitehorn, Susie Day. They are contributors to this magnificent book, Let Freedom Ring. You two share our perception that there was a real need, there was a real gap out there, and that this book fulfills that.
Well, yeah, I definitely think so. It's like an encyclopedia. It's not something that you're going to read on a weekend, you know, at the beach. It's a guide to how to fight for justice, to how to raise these cases, to who these people are, what kinds of organizations are there out there. There are historical documents about international law, which is very important. People don't realize that sometimes that international law, which the United States doesn't recognize half the time, has certain precepts that govern how political prisoners should be dealt with that are not followed in this country.
Yeah, I think there's also a burgeoning, unfortunately, political prisoner movement around the Green Scare, which I don't think is as represented in this book, and I probably will need an addendum.
Another book.
Yes, to represent all that's going on. And I think it probably would be good for the two movements to sort of like get a little more in touch with each other.
And I would add to that all the Muslims that were falsely accused and railroaded and salted away all across the country. That's starting to come to the fore also.
Yeah, and when Susie says it's unfortunate that the movement is burgeoning, she means because it's unfortunate that there are so many cases coming out, which is another important point, because for anyone who struggles for justice in this country at any level, you have to recognize that at some point people may go to prison. And that's the other reason, you know, we always say to people, what's in it for me? Why should I fight to free political prisoners? Well, if you end up being one, you're going to want people to fight for you.
I mean, any real movement that really that's going to make social change, there's going to be people getting hurt and going to prison as well.
These, mostly in this book, represent an amazing part of leftist history of the 60s and 70s, which when you see a movie about the Weather Underground or you read a book, you don't get the contact with, you know, people who are still in prison and the traffic in and out of prison at the time that was going on.
Anywhere you put your finger into this book and open it, there's something that'll be very moving and very important to read.
Poetry and manifestos and analysis.
It's really special.
An extraordinary document.
It's really special.
And we're grateful to the two of you for helping to put it together.
Well, and thanks for talking to us about it. I think this hopefully will generate a lot more discussion in our movement.
We know they can get the book in a lot of places. We'll put that on our website. But if they want to, like, join the struggle, what do you suggest? A lot of resources are in the back of the book, but
well, that's a good place to start. I mean, I think a good thing to do also is to go on the internet and just search U.S. political prisoners or search the Jericho Movement. .com or Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, mxgm.org, I guess, are two places that those just come to mind because I work with them here in New York who represent a lot of political prisoners and hold all kinds of events about political prisoners and are good clearinghouses for how to get involved.
And occasionally prisoners will have their own websites too, so you can Google them.
Well,
Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
And Susie.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. Today we're interviewing Frances Golden, a New Yorker who runs a left-wing literary agency. She has published or been responsible for the publishing of many books about Mamiya Abu-Jamal. She's going to discuss a new book by Mamiya, Jailhouse Lawyers. She's also going to talk to us about political prisoners and the six people, including Mamiya, on death row in Pennsylvania, who she regularly visits. It's a compelling and heartbreaking story, but a story of struggle. Welcome, Frances, to Law and Disorder.
I'm happy to be here.
We're honored to have you here because we've been talking about political prisoners and specifically the book Let Freedom Ring. But you have a special relationship with many political prisoners. Notably, you're Mumia Abu-Jamal's book editor, but you also regularly visit inmates on death row. Can you tell us about that?
It happened because I once went to visit Mumia as a visitor. He's allowed one visitor a week. And I came on a Sunday, having checked with the gatekeeper, and someone had dropped in on a Saturday. I brought Terry Bisson with me. I paid $500 for round-trip fare for both of us. We rented a car to get to the prison, and we went home without seeing him. I vowed never to do that again. In order not to do it, I had to become a member of the Pennsylvania Prison Society. $40 a year, you can see any prisoner anywhere in Pennsylvania, any time.
You're kidding.
It saved my life.
Even Mamiya?
Even Mamiya, if he's sitting with his lawyer.
You can walk in?
I can say, I need an hour with Mamiya.
Amazing.
If you're a PPSer. Now two people on my staff are PPSers, because they, when I don't go alone, they come with me. The fact is, a lot of people wanted to visit, see Mamiya, and they began to flood PPS with applications for membership. So they changed their rules. You can only be a member if you live in Pennsylvania. but I'm grandfathered in.
Grandmothered in.
Exactly. And it's a relief to me to be able to see prisoners. Now, another thing is that when you're a visitor, you see one prisoner. In PPS, you have to see prisoners, plural. And so Mumia gave me somebody he calls his son in prison, and then Sugar Bear, whose real name is Robert Lark. And then now I see five prisoners plus Mumia.
These are death row prisoners?
All of them are death row. And I hope I don't cry when I say this. Out of the six of them, five of them are innocent.
Wow. Oh my
They're
gosh.
On death row, and five of the six are innocent. I come every 3 months. I spend all day Saturday and all day Sunday from 8:30 till 3:30, those are visiting hours, with my six guys. And I do it four times a year. And I'm making sure that when I croak, other people are going to replace me and go at least four times a year, as long as Mumia is incarcerated.
All of us have visited people in prison, and Heidi particularly has visited Mumia. And it's just that sickening feeling you get when you leave after the visit and you hear that door slam.
Well, what's even worse is that you can't hug him, you can't kiss him, you can't shake his hand. You're behind very thick glass. There are quarter-inch screens on both sides of the cell where you can your voices travel through. It's insulting. It's awful. But it's what exists on death row.
And Francis, I cannot imagine how meaningful and precious that these visits are to all of the inmates you visit. Do you write to them in between visits?
Oh, of course. I write to them. I send them books. I call their Aunt Mamie. I call their lawyer. I have a little book with each of their names with 100 pages in between each name. And I sit with a pen and I write what they ask me to do. And then I and a lot of people on my staff, or at least Sarah, who's now a member of the gang that raises funds, along with you, Heidi, thank you, for Mumia's legal defense. She helps out with some of these purchases. But I'm now going to be a partnership. My left-wing agency is going to be a partnership. And one of the clauses, which they have not yet signed, is that the support of prisoners has to continue when I am no longer there.
For our listeners, Fran runs a literary agency that is quite well known. In fact, has published at least one of the books by a founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights. But what you're saying is this great clause that you're requiring all your partners to continue support for.
To change the prison system, which is outrageous. Yes. It's illegal, inhuman. The person who speaks most clearly about that is Angela Davis, who wrote the introduction along with Selma James to the book about jailhouse lawyers.
And that's about to be published, right?
You're referring to Mumia Abu-Jamal's newest.
Remarkable. His birthday is on April 24th, and all over the country there are 9 events, birthday parties taking place, at which the book will be the main guest of honor.
The book is called Jailhouse Lawyers, Prisoners Defending Prisoners Against the United States of America, the foreword by Angela Davis, the literary agent, our own wonderful Fran Golden.
So. Thank you.
And the book, aside from the fact that it's written by an incredible writer who is also, as of November 2007, a member of Penn, it talks about a subject that most people are not aware of, jailhouse lawyers. And the Guild has a category of membership for jailhouse lawyers, but they are really unsung heroes in terms of the support that they provide to other inmates.
That's quite true. One of the stories, not in the book, but one of the guys that I visit, incidentally, every prisoner has a nickname. This guy's nickname is Slim. And he was on the streets of Philadelphia at the age of 10, without a home, 10 years old, never went to school, got in trouble, wound up on death row. He learned to read in prison. He's a phenomenal jailhouse lawyer. He writes briefs.
Fabulous.
Huh. He spends days before he got a typewriter, as Mumia did, writing with a pen. and has helped prisoners get relief. It's amazing, the stories of these guys and what they have become in prison.
And Slim is a death row prisoner, right?
Absolutely.
And he's helping
Incidentally,
others.
These guys were not angels, aside from Mumia, who was an angel. They were involved in drug trade, other illegal activities, but they never pulled the trigger of the person for whom they were committed of killing. The one who pulled the trigger is walking the streets free in Philadelphia, having fingered the guys that are now in prison, which is not unlikely.
It's a common story.
That's a common story, and people don't know it. It should be more widely known so that people can get into the movement to end it.
Now, of the six you're visiting, one is Mumia, and we follow Mumia's case quite closely on this station. The other five, are they in terms of their legal proceedings, are they ongoing? Is there a vigorous defense for them?
One of them is defending himself, as I said, Slim. I think two of the others could get out. It would make my heart sing if that were to happen. Sugar Bear and Osiris might get out because their cases are up. But their cases, which when they have a trial goes well, it takes 3 or 4 years for the judge to make a decision. Do you know what this means to a guy on death row who's innocent? And there's nothing you can do to push them. They just take their time. And then if it gets into the federal level, these guys have a chance of getting out, either because they'll get a new trial or because they'll be kicked out for time served. And I wish it were true of all of them.
Have you gotten to know their attorneys?
3 of the 6. The others seem happy with their legal defense. I have one prisoner friend whose name is Russell Schultz. His nickname is Maroon. And he's not a death row prisoner. In other words, he will never be ever be executed. But he's in death row because he escaped from prison 3 times.
Good for him.
They could not keep him in behind bars. The only way they could keep him was to put him on death row. When the guys come in, their hands are shackled not behind their back, but in their front. And they get into the cell and they squat down and put their hands, a little window in the bottom of the door. And the guards, the two big burly guards that escort them in, untie their handcuffs so that when I see them, we either put our hands against the glass so that the warmth you can feel their hand, or you bang on the glass and they bang back. That's the way we shake hands. Russell Maroon is not only shackled, but he's tied to his waist, and they never untie him. Now, when I started a couple of years ago to dance with them, but now I do better. I do yoga with them. And it's wonderful because they feel their shoulders crack and they feel their hands when you pull their fingers. You can hear the crack of your fingers, and I beg them to do it when they're in their cells. And most of them do. I can't do that with Russell because his hands are tied to his waist. So I called the warden last Thursday, and I told him that in June I'm going to be 85. And I wanted a birthday present from the warden. I want him to unshackle Russell so we can do yoga. And he said he'd get back to me. It would be wonderful to be able to have him use his hands, which he can't do now. It's so inhuman.
You think there's a chance that he'll do it?
Okay. But the man is the oldest of the prisoners.
Yeah, but
he's
not well.
How old is he, Francis?
He might be 70.
Yeah.
He's ill. He needs.
He's on death row still?
He's only on death row because they can keep him in.
Right.
Yeah,
but this man is gentle. Yeah. He's small. He's wickedly intelligent. Huh. He's very political. Fortunately, he has loving daughters and a son. He and Mumia are the only ones that have a movement behind them. all of these guys could make an amazing difference in the general population. They're all dedicated to helping keep youth on the right path. They want to aid society in every way they can. They're all brilliant. They're all smart. They're articulate. They do not belong behind bars.
One of the bright spots in the depression that's upon us is that the states are now trying to save money, and they're actually talking about letting older prisoners out so they don't have to spend money keeping them behind bars.
Particularly Russell, who's not well. Who's not well. It should happen. And there has to be a movement of millions of people who press for it to happen. You know what Frederick Douglass said, without a demand, there's no progress. You know, we've got to make the demand.
I couldn't agree more. You know, when you start, when you don't make demands, you can never get more than you're asking for.
My own opinion is that, with the exception of some really violent, unrestrainable people, there's no use for prisons. And prisons are really a measure of what the society is all about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's no other country that's as guilty as we are.
None.
Not only incarceration of juveniles. There are awful states and cities in our country with regard to police abuse and unfair practices. L.A. is awful.
Chicago.
New Orleans, Chicago, Detroit, New York, all of them are awful. None of them are like Philadelphia. None of them are like Philadelphia. Wow. Twice the feds have come in and let 350 people out of jail with one cop who put them all in. And now, last week, there was a scandal about two judges who got millions, I think $2 or $3 or $4 million from people who wanted to build jails for juveniles.
Yeah.
This is typical of Philadelphia. It is corrupt from beginning to end. The police are more brutal than ever. I have a wonderful client named Lynn Washington, who's doing a book about the police in Philadelphia, but he said it would never happen if the courts and the judges were not tied up with the police to put innocent people behind bars. And that should be an eye-opener.
Francis, I'm curious, do you have relationships with the guards at the correctional facility?
Well, after 15 years, I do. And some of them are sweethearts. I've wanted to send some of them anniversary presents. They said, don't you dare. I can't accept anything, you know. When I went to prison when Mumia was in Philly, before he went to Green in Waynesburg, I brought two pumpkin pies. It was Thanksgiving. Two enormous, wonderful pumpkin pies. And the guard at the desk said, are you out of your mind? You can't bring a tissue into the prison. And I said,
that's right.
But it's Thanksgiving. One is for you and one is for the prisoners. He said, get out of here. You can't do. I didn't know. You know, I just didn't know how archaic these rules were. You can bring nothing, not even a tissue. You have to hide it. But if you're PPS, you can bring a book. You can bring two pens. You're like liberated.
Francis, do the guards, have you noticed, have a special fondness for some of the inmates?
Well, there are two guards at the front desk downstairs. They know all of my guys. They not only know them, they visit them. This guy, who's a gem, visits them. Death row is very different from general population, extremely different. General population, women can sit on their guys' laps. Their children can hug them and kiss them. You can go to the commissary and get sandwiches and apples and stuff. Nothing like that in death row, nothing like that. And there's also a wonderful guard upstairs. Now, there are also lousy guards, but the wonderful guard lets me go from cell to cell because I'm PPS, and I want to say hello to some of the other guys whom I know if they're having other visitors. Once I had a not wonderful guard, and I was wearing a jacket. I have to wear a jacket because I need pockets because of whatever I put in my pockets, something I want them to read, you know, which I can hold up against the glass, which I'm not supposed to bring in, but that's okay. So this guard was a jerk. and he didn't know me, and I didn't know him. And it was hot as hell, and I took off my jacket. I was wearing a blouse with a turtleneck, you know, very appropriate. And he rushes into the cell from his little glass booth, which he usually puts Mumia in the cell next to the glass booth so he can watch him very carefully. And he says, "You can't take off that jacket." I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, "You can't take off your jacket. You have to put it back on." I said, "Who says? You're going to make me put on my jacket if I'm warm?" I said, "I didn't take off my brassiere. I took off my outer jacket, for Christ's sake." He said, "No, you got to put it on." I said, "Call the warden. Get out of my
face."
You're
great, Francis. You're great. You're just great. Feisty
Francis. I mean,
Francis.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Take off your jacket when you're wearing a turtleneck shirt underneath it. But there are jerks and there are good guys. And Sugar Bear and others tell me just who's out there, you know, who I can have to be careful about and who I shouldn't be. The guy downstairs, as I said, not only visits them, but he knows their nicknames. He knows their prison names. It's wonderful to make friends with these guys, and there's nothing I can do to thank them because they're not allowed to have any thanks. I can't bring them an apple pie. You know, it's not allowed.
Francis, this is a heartwarming story of what you do every 3 months, and it's always an honor to have you on. We're excited about Mumia's new book.
The name of the new book is Jailhouse Lawyers, Prisoners Defending Prisoners Against the USA. It's Mumia Abu-Jamal's book, forward by Angela Davis.
And Selma James.
And Selma James, and of course brought to you by Fran Golden.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fran.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Today we talk with New York-based educator and activist Matt Meyer. Matt is the editor of several books, including the recently published Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners. Let Freedom Ring presents a two-decade sweep of essays, analyses, histories, interviews, resolutions, People's Tribunal verdicts, and poems by and about the scores of U.S. political prisoners and the campaigns to safeguard their rights and secure their freedom. We're pleased to have Matt with us today to give us more background on Let Freedom Ring.
Matt Meyer, you've presented us and the world this really much-needed, fills a gap, and encyclopedic Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners. Matt Meyer edited the book. It came out at the end of 2008, and it really is quite extraordinary. For one thing, it's the size of a Manhattan phone book.
It's so big because, Michael, as you said, it filled a gap, and I'm sure Matt will tell us this is a huge gap. I mean, people in this country, what do they think about political prisoners, Matt?
Mainly, they don't know they exist, and that's the key piece. We felt like, in addition to saying there are political prisoners, yes, Virginia, there are political prisoners in the U.S., we wanted to say there's been a history of movements to support those prisoners and to free them. And this book doesn't even look at the entire history of political imprisonment in the U.S. It really focuses on the last 25 years, which we saw as a key era that took us through the late 60s and 70s movements for social change and the repression that the U.S. government at that time and since that time has tried to wage against them. So this book does try to fill a gap. And there is a piece of it, we say, that it's actually not hard to edit a book that's over 900 pages. You just don't say no to anyone. You say yes, and people send their stuff in, and it's quite an easy thing to do. But we try to be as representative as possible of diverse strategies and diverse movements because the prisoners themselves represent many, many different movements.
Well, talk to us about the diverse movements and then about the strategies, because what we think is particularly helpful to not just get some firsthand knowledge about these magnificent, courageous people, but to get some ideas and strategies on how to help them and get them out of there.
Exactly, Michael. I mean, I think the Political Prisoner 101 piece is that the majority of movements of peoples that have been in prison come from the black, the civil rights and black liberation movement, come from the American Indian movement and Native American movements, come from the Puerto Rican and Chicano movements, and come from some white allies and supporters. So you see those movements reflected the most in this book, and you see them reflected the most in terms of who political prisoners are today.
Matt, what does it mean to be a political prisoner?
Well, in general, and we try to give a more technical and international human rights Geneva-based definition, but a more generalized definition, it's worth saying that political prisoners are folks who are in jail because of the ideas they've had as much as the acts they've committed. So in addition to, say, the Puerto Ricans who were charged with seditious conspiracy, essentially thought crimes, you also have people who allege that they were framed and that, in fact, they're doing time. And in the case of some freed ones like the Rubén Wahad of the Black Panther Party or Geronimo Gijaga, similarly, they were able to prove after years that through the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO and others, they were framed. And, of course, there are many more in jail still who are, you know, claiming the same thing and saying, look, we didn't do it. We were caught up in a moment. But then there are also folks who, in fact, did do different actions in support of their movements and who were given sentences that were far, far in excess of any similar act, criminal act or otherwise. And so the political prisoners are folks who either were in jail initially because of their political work and beliefs or who are in jail still 20, 30 years with incredibly long sentences and incredibly harsh conditions, and that's how we would generally define political prisoners.
Matt, talk to us about the ideas we get from all the wonderful contributors to this book that kind of merge into notions of strategies and what we can do to help.
Exactly. Michael, you said earlier that this book isn't just about the political prisoners' voices. It's really not. It does some political prisoner 101. Who are they? How do you define them? And what are they themselves saying? But it also really is a collection of documents from the movements to free them. And so it looks at tactics and strategies and how some of those tactics and strategies can be applied today and maybe how some others shouldn't be applied today, how we need to make new ones for this new era that we're in. I'll give you some examples. We have from the Puerto Rican movement a collection of documents that began with basic public education, led to international tribunals, an international forum held here, held in Europe, held in Puerto Rico itself, that said, okay, these prisoners have some criminal cases, have some things that need to be looked at from the legal point of view. They have human rights interests, so the grassroots need to be built and mobilized, but there are also some international human rights issues that also need to be addressed. In the case of the Puerto Ricans, these tribunals created a great amount of attention, including from a dozen Nobel laureates, Nobel Peace laureates and others, to say, at that time to President Clinton, these are issues that are not just of concern to the United States. These are issues of U.S. human rights abuses to peoples being held in their prisons. So therefore, the whole global community needs to look at that. And that was one strategy that was quite effective. You know, I think the Puerto Rican, the 12 that were freed, their freedom really came about through a combination of grassroots support and international pressure.
We're speaking with Matt Meyer, who's recently edited a magnificent, thick volume, Let Freedom Ring, about political prisoners in the United States. Matt, we've been talking about strategies that have been developed through the movement to put the spotlight of public opinion on these people and give them a voice and help get them out. And you were talking about the international strategy that was so effective with Puerto Rican prisoners. Please continue.
Well, yeah, I was saying this in many cases, a combination of strategies that need to be used. And I think part of this volume is to say to activists, to lawyers, to scholars, and to the various movements today, that we can build upon the strategies that have been used in the last 20 years. We can look at some of the documents, some of the tribunals, civil disobediences, some of the legal casework, and we can take that and develop new movements for the prisons that are in today. I believe, and many of us who helped put the book together believe, that there's a greater level of general consciousness within the progressive movement about the fact of political prisoners. There's a greater level of political consciousness about the fact of a huge prison industrial complex that is bringing so many people, not necessarily folks who are political, but folks who have done maybe tiny offenses, but we have a prison complex that's grown and is imprisoning huge numbers of people. And I think those movements do need some strategies for this time and for this moment. And I think this book helps to look towards some things that have been done and some things that still need to be done.
Matt Meyer, can you give us a sense of some of the political prisoners that are featured in the book, Let Freedom Ring?
Well, the majority of the political prisoners in jail and in the book are from the Black movement, as I said. So Mumia's case is well known, but we also have information about people like Sundiata Okoli, Mutulu Shakur, obviously the case of the San Francisco Eight, which is very pressing today. These are eight former Black Panthers who are facing charges of a murder that was committed in the 1970s. These men have lived 30 years of their lives without any criminal activity and without any problem with the law. And this particular case of a cop killing from 3 decades ago has at best very, very flimsy evidence.
Matt, I notice that you've also, in some of the most recent cases, included the Green Scare defendants, Daniel McGowan and others, and the Guild has been following this because of the rapidity, really, and the zeal with which the FBI has called these groups the number one domestic terrorism threat.
Indeed, and I think that there's a strong movement to say, okay, we can try to separate these young, primarily white activists who are focused on animal rights and animal liberation efforts, who are interested in Earth First or Earth liberation or environmental issues. And these are folks we can target and separate from these older Black or Puerto Rican nationalists, the younger folks mainly anarchists, the older folks not so much so. And I think there's been a real attempt to divide these movements. That's another strategy that we look at. And I think another example in the book is the Iraqi Veterans Against War, IVAW. And we have young conscientious objectors, young pacifists. And these are folks across the racial spectrum, you know, Puerto Rican, Black, and white, who are part of IVAW, Iraqi Veterans Against the War, but also part of general conscientious objection and nonviolence groups. And those, too, are prisoners of conscience and political prisoners who don't often see themselves as part of, or not often seen as part of, the larger movement around political imprisonment and repression.
What was it that caused you to do this work, to bring out Let Freedom Ring? What do you think personally, politically, about what goes on in this country, and why did you spend all the time you did in laboring to put out this really magnificent volume?
I think the main sense that I had and the folks that I work with on this book had, there was an opportunity at this time. Obviously, as an activist myself for many years, I've been part of the War Resisters League. I've been in touch with the Puerto Rican movements especially, in touch with the Nobel laureates. There was a sense that a broader range of people within the peace and justice community could and should have some attention paid to these folks who are languishing in jail. And I think on a personal level, that was the impetus. It was the understanding that some of these documents, that some of this information was readily available, but not on the internet, not in any one volume, in people's files here and there buried, that information, like the prisons themselves, needed to be unearthed and needed to be brought home. And so this volume was designed as a tool with some of that information that we hoped would spark new movements, because we did feel, again, from the point of view of War Resisters League, from the point of view of folks in the international human rights community, that there was a space to call attention to Panthers, you know, even though the Black Panthers don't exist anymore, even though some of the movements that the Puerto Ricans who were incarcerated, even though the American Indian movement may not be what it was in the 1970s, that in fact that these folks who are still inside 20, 30 years later needed our attention, needed our support, and needed a final push to bring them home.
And it must have been a massive undertaking to contact all these individuals and to collect all the data and written materials. Did you do this alone?
There was a group of folks who I work with, a local collective here in New York City, Resistance in Brooklyn. The publishers as well were very helpful. The book is published by PM Press and co-published by a Canadian group, Kerplezablet, and actually those are the best ways of getting the book. Let Freedom Ring at pmpress.org or kersplebedeb.com, if you can spell that. pmpress.org is a little easier to spell. This grouping of people, in many cases, because we've done some work with the political prisoner movements, that stuff was forthcoming. People were very generous and very excited about having some of these documents printed. Also, it is true, I've been a bit of a pack rat, so some of it was in my own basement, and that's a good thing. But I think there was especially a conscientious sense that we needed to look beyond what was in any one basement. So yes, the Green Scare materials, the Iraqi Veterans Against the War materials, materials that didn't just focus on, say, the Mumia movement in the U.S., but looked at some of the work that was done in France and some of the work that's been doing elsewhere, was brought together so we'd have it under one cover.
Anywhere you open this book, it's actually quite fabulous.
Yeah, that's...
Freedom Ring. I just opened it up, and there's the interview that you yourself, Matt, did with Meg Starr in 1991 of Assata Shakur. Now, of course, one question I have is, Assata lives in Cuba, so how did you do the interview?
We were down in Cuba, actually.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's okay. Are the cops here? No, that's all right. They're fine. This is the WBA studio, so we're safe at least for another 5 or 6 minutes. Yeah, we were actually down in Cuba, though, doing research on the African roots of Cuban culture and history. And one can make a connection, perhaps not academic in total. Assata's asylum in Cuba is part of that history of Cuban-African relations. There you go. You're going to defend me,
Michael?
Well,
no, that's good. That's fine. I mean, the book is really, I just want to say, everywhere you open it, it's just like a history as well as not just a history, but a political action book. And the end has loaded with resources if you want to work on any case or general cases. But if you ever any doubt, there's political prisoners in the United States.
Yeah, just try to pick this book up.
Right.
It's called Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners, edited by Matt Meyer, forward by Nobel Peace Laureate Adolfo Perez Esquivel, with an afterword by Lynn Stewart, and another one by Ashanti Austin. It's a really fine book. Every listener to this show should have Let Freedom Ring. You can get it again where, Matt?
You can get it at pmpress.org, or I have to say the co-publisher, kersplebedeb.com.
You mentioned that people need to know there are political prisoners, and now that they know, for the people who know and care, what can they do?
Probably to give the quick, you know, one-sentence answer in terms of getting some web information, the Jericho Movement is the single major national clearinghouse for political prisoners in the U.S. There are lots of incredible and important local and regional ones. There are lots of groups that work on individual or groupings of cases. But in terms of the broad spectrum of political prisoners, going to the Jericho Movement, just the way it's spelled, you know, just the way it sounds, thejerichomovement.com is probably the best thing people can do.
In the movement, people need to hear about successes and the fact that their work really does matter. Can you tell us about some of them?
So I guess, yeah, I mean, the one closest to my heart and the one that I worked most intimately on were the campaign around the Puerto Rican political prisoners and prisoners of war. Now, here's a group of folks, 15, captured in 1980. And for the better part of almost 10 years, there was a sense that these folks would never see the light of day. There was a sense, even within parts of the Puerto Rican community, that these folks were not terrorists, but somehow on the wrong track. By the late 1980s, there was the rumblings of a movement that said, wait a second, we have to look at this a different way. And it mainly was from the Puerto Rican community and from some of their allies and supporters saying, look, whatever tactics these guys used, whatever strategies we may disagree with, there's a basic and fundamental human rights issue that folks who are essentially fighting for independence would get charged with seditious conspiracy, a thought crime, and get put in jail for decades and decades and decades. We have to create a movement that will pressure the government to look at something different. Essentially, two things happened. One is just basic, plain, door-to-door organizing in Puerto Rico and within the Puerto Rican communities here was done, and was done consistently, and was done with some tight organizations, so that you had petitions, and you had house parties, and you had church meetings and discussions. Parallel to that, you also had this international human rights work that was being done, where you had non-Puerto Ricans within the U.S. and around the world getting information about the case and saying, ah, okay, the situation of Puerto Rico is not unlike the situation of Namibia. It's not unlike the situation of colonialism anywhere else. The imprisonment of the Puerto Ricans is not unlike the imprisonment of the East Timorese leadership before independence. So you have people like Nobel laureate José Ramos Horta, and you have people like Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, who wrote the foreword to Let Freedom Ring, from himself, a former political prisoner from Argentina. And you have people like Archbishop Tutu saying, okay, we have to get behind this campaign. And then part of that was also looking at other movements within the United States. Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King, obviously, and the King family, ended up supporting the Puerto Rican prisoners. So the combination of an international campaign and a major grassroots movement made it so that President Clinton and, we now know that Eric Holder, current Attorney General, played some behind-the-scenes role in saying, aha, there has to be some clemency and some amnesty offered them. And, of course, that was done at the end of Clinton's term. And 12 of the 15 came out. Others were paroled. And two, Oscar Lopez Rivera and Carlos Alberto Torres, are still inside and were still working for their release. But this was a situation where 10 years before their release, even 5 years before their release, there was no sense at all that these folks would actually get out. In fact, they did, and they got out to huge crowds and hero worship and a great amount of excitement within the Puerto Rican community that lasts to this day.
I think that's an extremely good example of giving people a reason to fight. You know, my office and others, the Guild, et cetera, represented a lot of these people over various phases of those prosecutions, from grand juries to everything else. And if you would have asked us probably at that time they went in, are there any chance these guys are going to get out in our lifetimes? I think everybody would have said, it's not going to happen. And it just demonstrates that with the right kind of a grassroots and international movement, you can do it. So congratulations to all of you, and Matt particularly, for putting this book together.
A wonderful, wonderful compendium.
Let Freedom Ring, edited by Matt Meyer. You can get it by going to www.pmpress.org. Matt, really just a pleasure to have you on our show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let Freedom Ring. Matt. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.